So we started looking at experimental probes of this WIMP dark matter framework. And one of the things we showed is that the same interaction that gives you WIMP annihilation can lead to scattering of WIMPs off of nuclei. And so we were able to derive some differential cross-section for the WIMP scattering off of a nucleus, which I've given here. And then the total counting rate we can express in terms of this cross-section. So there's some the target number density, so this is related to the number of nuclei in my experiment. I have some parameters here that are related to the astrophysics of the WIMP halo. And so this, of course, we don't know, and we have to make certain assumptions about what that looks like. And then there's the particle physics content, which tells me what's the probability of scattering per unit energy. So were there any questions about anything that we talked about yesterday? If you've had more time to think about it. Okay, so what we wanted to do then was we wanted to derive the form of this matrix element so that we could actually just compute the rate. And what we found is that the characteristic recoil momenta are of the order of 100 MeV or so, mega electron volts, which is a lot smaller than most of the masses that we would consider in typical beyond the standard model theories. And so we found it useful to, instead of introducing some mediator and keeping track of a mediator, the physics would be equally well described by just a four-point interaction between two quarks and two dark matter particles. Now, because this is a contact interaction, we know that fermions have dimensions of three halves. So this tells us that we don't have dimensionless coefficients. These coefficients all go like some mass scale to the minus two. But basically, this encodes all of the information about the coupling to the mediator and the relative couplings between dark matter and chi and what the mass of the mediator is, and sort of bundles it into one unknown quantity, because our final answer is only going to depend on this one particular combination of all of those unknowns. So now what we want to do is I can take my ultraviolet particle physics theory that has mediators, and I can basically do an expansion of all the propagators and put them in this form. So it's relatively straightforward for me to go from interactions of the form, chi bar chi plus phi plus q bar q phi, and write it in terms of these kinds of interactions. So what we do is we just sort of write down all of the possible ways that we can connect these that preserve parity. What we find is that depending on whether we're putting gamma fives in or gamma mus, we get different structures associated with them. So each of the gamma mus is contracted with another gamma mu, so we get a Lorentz invariant. And then the presence or lack of gamma five ensure parity conservation. Yes. So it turns out that depending on whether there's a gamma five here or not will change the properties of the interaction. And so typically, if you violate parity, then you expect to populate all of these possible operators, and then you're just dominated by whatever is the biggest one. Okay. So in some sense, we're already accounting for this, and it just turns out that the scattering rates tend to be somewhat hierarchical in terms of the operators. So you don't actually need to preserve parity in your theory, but this turns out to be a reasonable like basis of things to work with.
So there could be a term which is like a pseudoscalar scalar interaction that
That's right. So for instance, if you look at the annihilation of a pseudoscalar, remember we talked about S wave versus P wave, that some interaction processes depend on the velocity of the incoming state. So it turns out that annihilation of QQ bar through a pseudoscalar is S wave, whereas through a scalar is P wave. And you also get a velocity suppression if you have, like for instance, or you can get a velocity suppression if it's mixed, but then you say, well, if I'm already breaking parity, then I would generically expect to have this operator. So because that is the largest contribution, I can kind of neglect the other thing. So, I mean, if you're being really careful and systematic, then you should include all of those. But what we're talking about now doesn't really change appreciably. Okay, you could basically follow the same procedure. Okay, any other questions about the interactions that we're considering? All right, so The main challenge in direct detection experiments is that we're scattering off of nuclei. And nuclei, of course, are bound states of quarks and gluons. And so if I'm probing these things at energies much larger than the confining energy, so there's this energy scale that we denote by lambda QCD, which is of order a few hundred MeV. I should say that energy or momenta that's much bigger than this, then quarks are okay, because you're essentially the wavelength of the particle that you're scattering is small enough that you're probing the individual quark-like structure of the nucleon or the nucleus. But if I'm scattering at energies less than this, which is characteristically true in direct detection experiments, then I actually need to consider scattering off of the bound state. And so we need some way of mapping our fundamental theory onto scattering off of the bound states. Now, this is hard because the definition of lambda QCD is basically where the strong gauge coupling goes to infinity. So I'm sure in your QFT class, you computed the beta function for a QCD with three flavors, and you found that it has a pole at a few hundred MeV. And there's not actually something that's going infinite, but we just lose complete calculational control there. So you can question, well, how on earth do we go from some UV theory down to a theory that consists of bound states, because we can't use perturbation theory? And the answer to that is that, first of all, we have to rely extensively on lattice QCD, so calculations that are done without reference to perturbation theory, and also experimental inputs where we're actually measuring hadronic physics. But we can use the parity and Lorentz structure of these operators to kind of match the interactions in the full theory down to the interactions in the bound state theory. Okay, so let's try to be a little bit more concrete about this. So normally, we write down a matrix element associated with a Feynman diagram. So we have some chi, say. So now we have a nucleus and nucleus coming in and out. What this matrix element really means is I'm computing some expectation value where I have some outgoing states, and then I have an interaction Hamiltonian, and then I have some incoming states. And this is basically this, some term of my perturbative expansion. So there are other things where I have multiple insertions of the interaction Hamiltonian. But basically, this is what a matrix element is. Okay? So our interaction here is just going to be one of these interactions here. So I'm going to just generically refer to this as Q bar capital gamma and chi bar capital gamma chi, just to kind of stand in for all of the possible, here gamma is little gamma mu gamma 5, here capital gamma is just the identity matrix. So what I'm basically computing is my outgoing state is going to be some nucleus out, some chi out, and then I'll have chi bar gamma chi q bar gamma q, some nucleus out, in chi in. Now, these two things factorize, because the basically these operators, remember, you can expand them in terms of creation and annihilation operators, and they act on various elements of the incoming outgoing states. But basically, the chi parts talk to the chi's in the initial state, and the q bars talk to the nuclear information in the initial and final state. So you probably showed this in QFT, but this factorizes into something that's like an out q bar gamma q and in times chi out chi bar gamma chi. Okay, so this just falls to the fact that these things are completely different fields. If you didn't have an interaction Hamiltonian, then they wouldn't actually interact. So this whole thing is describing the interaction as it is. Okay. All right, so now we need to think back to, like, way, way back when we were first deriving the Feynman rules. And in the with from the Feynman rules, basically these kinds of matrix elements are what transformed into these, you know, U bar U and V bar U kinds of terms from the external wave function of the spinners, right? So basically, you can think of as you can expand these in terms of creation annihilation operators, and I want some annihilation operator to kill this state and one creation operator to kill that state. And so what you're really doing is just sort of matching up fields with possible external states. And each time you do that, you have an insertion of the external wave function. Okay. And you probably derive this in full. I'm not going to go through the full derivation because it's pretty long. But the point is just that you can think of it as I'm just saying, OK, well, you know, these two things line up, and they give me a U in. And these two things line up, and they give me a U chi, say, out. And this is where your U bars and your Feynman rules come from, really, if you break it down. Okay. So for the chi's, it's pretty straightforward. This is just the same as we've been doing all along, except there's one possible subtlety, which is that chi is uncharged. And so there are two possibilities for chi. So we can have chi is equal to chi bar. So basically, chi is its own antiparticle. This is what we refer to as a Majorana fermion. And it's possible that chi is not equal to chi bar. This is called a Dirac fermion. Now, all the particles in the standard model, once they get masses, are Dirac fermions because they're charged, with the possible exception of the neutrinos. And it's still an open question about whether the neutrinos are Majorana or Dirac. Now, have you heard of this difference before? Okay. So for something that's a Majorana, because a particle is the same as its antiparticle, I can actually, Q bar is the same as Q. And so I have two possible ways of connecting these. I can either connect this operator to the incoming field and this operator to the outgoing fields, or I can connect this one to the incoming field and this one to the outgoing fields. And it just has to do with the fact that there's nothing that distinguishes these two fields. And so when I'm expanding out this matrix element, you know, there's Wick's theorem that you use to expand all these things out, and you get that's what gives you an external wave function of the propagators. So for Majorana, we get an extra factor of 2. When I expand this matrix element. So basically, we define this as equal to some number kappa times u bar chi out gamma u chi in, where kappa equals 1 if chi is Dirac, and it's 2 if chi is Majorana. So you've probably seen something like this before. So for instance, if I'm writing down a scalar field theory potential, so let's do a temporary digression to a scalar field theory. So often, if I write down a theory of a real scalar, the potential looks something like half m squared phi squared plus 1 over 4 factorial lambda phi to the fourth. And if I write down something that's complex, so in other words, phi is not equal to phi bar, then this is okay, so yes.
Technically, you know, chi bar is a Dirac conjugate, right? So
that's right. So
when that equals chi,
Right, so what we really mean here is that chi bar is equal to sort of some chi bar, like what we sort of mean by this is chi bar conjugate. So I take the complex conjugate of both fields. So I don't actually like using four component spinners because I think it's really confusing, but I don't know how, to what extent you guys have used two component spinners, and I sort of don't want to get into that, but it's easy to see the difference. Okay, but the point is that normally, we automatically account for these different factors in when we were writing down the potential. So for instance, when we write down the Higgs potential with a complex scalar, there's usually no factor of 2 here, and there's a factor of 4 here. Whereas when you write down a scalar potential, there's a factor of 1 over 2 and a factor of 1 over 4 factorial, which is accounting for the fact that because it's real, you can connect the initial and final states to both a phi and a phi star, or you know, basically here you can connect this chi into this chi or that chi. So you end up with these extra factors of 2. Normally, what we do is we just change the coefficients of the operators so that when we do our Feynman rules, we always end up without any numerical coefficients. So if I write down the Feynman rules for phi to the fourth theory, both of these particles will just give me lambda. Okay, but here, because we're not separately, you know, we're not putting in a factor of 2 by hand, whether chi is Majorana or not, it shows up in the matrix element. And unfortunately, this is the convention, so you just have to kind of remember that. So even if you don't quite understand this whole conversation, the only thing to remember is that with a Majorana fermion, you get this extra factor of 2, just because it's real, there are more possibilities that you have to sum over when you're evaluating this matrix element. Okay. All right. So this is the chi matrix element, and all we're doing is we're being slightly more explicit about what we were implicitly doing when we were calculating Feynman diagrams. Like in the Feynman diagram you did in the tutorial last time, you just did this without even thinking of it, essentially. Okay. The problem is that now we need to evaluate this quark matrix element. So this one, it's fine. That's just the normal thing. Okay. So the whole point of this lecture is to evaluate this n out q bar gamma q n in matrix element. Okay, and it turns out that this, not surprisingly, is going to depend possibly on the structure of the whole nucleus. So even though our point-like interaction is with quarks, when we take this matrix element, it's going to depend on the nuclear structure. And so in particular, we find that there are subsets of interactions that that are independent of the spin of the nucleus. So these are interactions, as we'll see, like scalar and vector. And so we'll consider these first. And then second, we'll consider interactions that are dependent on the spin of the nucleus. And these are going to be the pseudoscalar an axial vector. Now, this isn't totally surprising. So at least in the case of an axial vector, the only axial vector that we know about at low energies is the momentum operator. So we know that momentum is an axial vector because angular momentum is, you know, schematically r cross p. If I do a parity transformation, I flip both of these vectors. And so you have this strange property that angular momentum doesn't change sign under a parity transformation. And so if we have interactions that transform like axial vectors, then when we match them onto some non-relativistic stuff, it's not surprising that spin is suddenly showing up. Okay? That what you're really interacting with is the total angular momentum. Okay? But the first example is the easiest one, so we'll talk about spin-independent scattering first. Okay, so what we want is this nucleus in, nucleus out with a quark interaction in the matrix element. But we're actually going to go in stages. We're first going to start from the quark level description. And then we're going to match that onto the nucleon description. So by nucleon, I mean protons and neutrons. This turns out to actually be the hard step. The reason is that it's the quarks and gluons are bound up in the nucleons, and then those nucleons are subsequently bound by sort of residual effect of the strong force into nuclei. But that is actually the QCD phase transition mostly affects this step here. Okay, so this is going to be the hard part, and then we need to take our matrix element in terms of nucleons and convert it into a nuclear matrix element. Okay. So let's write out our nucleon matrix elements. So we have nucleon out, Q bar gamma Q, nucleon one in. So I told you that the scalar and the vector operators are spin independent. This is sort of something you have to believe for now, and then we'll show later that it's true. So we're going to consider the special case of gamma is equal to gamma mu. So this is a vector. The scalar is similar, and this is something that you'll do in the tutorial. Okay. All right, so what we really want is this matrix element n out, q bar gamma mu q, and n. And what we notice is that this is a very familiar form to us. This is something that shows up in a Lagrangian, okay? So if I write down, for instance, a coupling of electromagnetism, so say, you know, electromagnetism, that looks something like E times the electromagnetic gauge boson times Q bar gamma mu Q, okay? So this is just what you get when you take the kinetic term and swap the derivative in for a covariant derivative. You automatically get this. Okay. So we can already tell that there's something special about this, because this has the form of some vector coupled to some current, okay, where some of this current is q bar gamma mu q. And currents, in particular, can be broken down as the zero component is basically the density, the charge density, and the spatial components are just the spatial current, like the amount of charge that's flowing from one place to another. So we can see that this matrix element is going to have some connection to, say, the electromagnetic current or really any current. Now it turns out that this quantity q bar gamma mu q, this is just the number of q's minus the number of q bars locally, sorry, the zero component of this. And this you can also see from this form, because you have, you know that your electromagnetic gauge boson couples to this current, you know that this current is conserved. And so the total number of charge just comes from integrating this current. And that's just going to be equal to, you know, if I have charge E, then the total charge is just E times the number of positive charges minus, you know, the number of particles with negative charge, the opposite charge. And you can actually just show this explicitly. So I think this is done in Peskin chapter 3, where if you expand these Qs and Q bars in terms of your creation annihilation operators, you end up with something that's kind of like, do I have it written out? Yeah, you end up with something like the integral of J0 over D3x can be written as the sum of your A dagger A's minus your B dagger B's, where these are creation annihilation operators for your quark field and these are for the anti-quark field. Yes, Huber.
So the Q's are just are we considering
other indices like
the
No, so these, so this is right. So in general, you'll have different values of this for each generation. Okay. Yeah, so the only way that this operator can be gauge invariant is if the color indices of these Qs are contracted together. So all you have is the easiest way of contracting these color indices. As for flavor indices, so you can, in principle, have different generation couplings. But it turns out that for the things that we're considering, the matrix elements are only non-zero if they're the same generation for both of them. Okay. So basically, again, you can go and derive this for yourself if you're really interested in doing it. But basically, what this Q bar gamma mu Q does is it just counts the number of Q in the nucleon, right? Because this is some conserved quantity that's proportional to the number of particles versus number of antiparticles. And so when I take its expectation value and some background, my nucleons have some net quark content associated with them. So for instance, my proton is up, up, down. My neutron is up, down, down. And then plus there's going to be some small contributions from like, I have, here's my proton, and maybe it spits off a gluon, and there's some loops. So, maybe there are some strange charm and other quarks in here. But what's true about these is that these loops always produce equal numbers of, say, S quark and S bar quark, or C quark and C bar quark. And so if I have an operator that's counting the net number of each quark type, then this is only non-zero if there is some net number of Q in the nucleon. Okay. So in particular, there are two up quarks and one down quark in the proton. And so if we consider the sum over quarks of proton out, proton in, this is just going to be equal to 2 times the up quark contribution, okay, and 1 times the down quark contribution of the same thing, but just with P is here in the matrix element. Okay. So the idea is that I'm sort of using the fact that the number of quarks in a nucleon is some fixed quantity on net to convert my quark level description into a proton level description. Yes, Hubert.
Third line from the bottom, you said that's non-zero if only the number of...
If net number of quarks is non-zero. If net number of... So okay. Q is some particular kind of quark. Okay. So if Q is... What I mean is that if I... So what I mean is just this, that... If I scatter off a proton, there's some probability of scattering off of some other quark just because of higher loop processes. But my proton is made up of, so we could, basically you can think of a proton as there's some up quark, down quark, a down quark. And then, so these are what we call valence quarks. And then these are all interacting in various ways. And so you can have other little quarks that are popping up here and there. But those quarks are coming from gluons, which always produce, quark-antiquark pairs. Yeah. So by net, I just mean that if you sum up, the density in the proton of Q minus the density of Q bar.
The usual kind of quark
content. That's right. That's right. Yeah.
And that's it should be up, up, down?
Oh, yeah. It's up, up. Sorry. The proton is up, up, down. So basically what this means, if you kind of pare back all of the formalism, is just that this nucleon as a whole, a proton is 2 up quarks and a down quark. And so my coupling to those nucleons is just going to be twice the coupling of the up quark plus 1 time the up coupling of the down quark. Okay. Now, yes. Yeah, so this is the corresponding operator for the nucleon. Because what we need in order to use this is we need to have the operator and the external state be the same thing. Okay, because then we can just turn it into the normal Dirac spinner wave functions. The problem here is that the operator does not match the outgoing and incoming states. And so what we need to do is sort of write this matrix element that was in terms of quarks in terms of operators in P and P bar. Okay. Because in the low energy theory, I'm actually scattering off of protons. I'm not scattering off of quarks.
So we are using Nash's theorem, and we are saying that, if this is a non-perturbative result,
mm-hmm.
and that's why we can do this.
That's right. So it's because of the fact that there's an exactly conserved symmetry in my theory. And that symmetry is this NQ minus NQ bar, that I can put in as many insertions of the coupling as I like, and it's always going to create quark anti-quark pairs. It's never going to give me a new quark. Okay. And so that symmetry allows us to just write down the answer in the low energy theory. Now, this turns out not to be true for any of the other operators. For the other operators, we literally just define numerical coefficients that relate this to this, and then you have to go and look them up in a book. Or if you're very ambitious, you know, do the lattice QCD calculation yourself. But the reason why I'm going through this particular example is because it shows you how, if you're careful in how you look at symmetries, if there's a symmetry of both the high energy theory and the low energy theory, then we can figure out non-perturbative results exactly by making use of this symmetry. But really what's going on is we're trying to change our interaction, exchange it for quarks, and instead talk about it in terms of nucleons. Yes, Kira.
So how do we go from the fact that you've got Q bar gamma zero to Q bar gamma
zero? Okay, so formally this is a conserved current, and so it's kosher to do it in the four vector language. The way that I would argue this is that we're doing a non-relativistic expansion. The nucleon isn't moving in my lab frame. It's sitting there, and so the spatial current is zero. So basically the entirety of this J mu is in this one component. Okay. But that's a good question. There's sort of some implicit simplification. Here I'm just sort of waving my hands to argue why it's true. But really, you can use the fact that there's some gauge symmetry that's coupled to this current. You know, an unbroken gauge symmetry coupled to this current has to be conserved. And so because this current is conserved, we can rewrite the low energy degrees of freedom in terms of the charges of the high energy degrees of freedom. Okay, so this is what my matrix element is for protons. I can do the same thing for neutrons. So for neutrons, it's just the same thing. I'm going to sum over all of my different quarks. So this is telling me that if I'm coupling to any quark that's not up or down, it doesn't actually couple to the proton. Similarly, if this is just going to be 1 times the up charge plus 2 times the down charge of the corresponding neutron operator. And this is just taking account of the fact that there are two down quarks and 1 up quark in the neutron. So I'm just adding up the interactions with down quarks and interactions with up quarks. And this tells me the total interaction. Now what this looks like is if instead of having the Lagrangian characterized by these interactions, if instead I had what we call an effective Lagrangian, which is basically 2b up plus p down, chi bar gamma mu chi, p bar gamma mu p, and b up plus 2b down, chi bar gamma mu chi, n bar gamma mu n. So basically, I can now just take this Lagrangian and derive Feynman rules from it, and I get this matrix element. And so once I figured out this matching, then I just do all of my calculations with this, and I forget about that other high energy theory. So the problem is that, you know, if I'm writing down a very complete theory of the universe, it's going to talk about quarks. And so this allows me to map that onto, this is really the physical Lagrangian for scattering, right? Because this is actually talking about the degrees of freedom that you're bumping into. And it's simpler in this case, but it proceeds the same way for the scalar case. It's just instead of being able to completely determine what these coefficients are, instead of a 1 and a 2, there's going to be some sort of fudge factor there. Yes.
So these are completely determined by QCD,
right? Yeah, so this is an input of my theory. That's just something that I know. And yeah, so I can say that B up is 1 and B down is 0, and then I know exactly what my coupling to protons is. Okay. And so, yeah. Yeah. So for the scalars, as you'll show, it's basically this times some other numerical factor that accounts for the fact that in the absence of this current conservation, it's a more non-trivial relationship between the matrix elements. But you're basically doing the exact same procedure. Okay, so we're almost done. Except the thing you're actually scattering off of is a nucleus, not the nucleon. Okay. So, however, the energies that we're looking at, the momenta, I say, which is the relevant thing, this is of order 100 MeV. The corresponding wavelength is large compared to the nucleon. Okay. And it's also quite large compared to, so this is basically always true. Okay. But it's also relatively large compared to the nucleus. The reason for this is just that the nuclear binding energy is quite tight. I mean, the strong interaction is very strong. It holds the nucleons together very, very strongly. And so what happens is I sort of have my dark matter coming in, and I have some collection of nucleons here. If I come in and scatter, but the sort of characteristic wavelength is larger than the size of these respective of the nucleus as a whole, then I'm scattering off of one of these nucleons, but I don't really know which nucleon it is, because the system as a whole gets deflected in a very relatively gentle way. And so I can't actually pin back and say, oh, it was this nucleon that I scattered off of. Okay. So what you're really doing is you're summing together the contributions of scattering off of each of these nucleons. But in quantum mechanics, if we don't have a way of determining which thing we scattered off of, then what we do is we sum over all of the possibilities and then we square it. Right? Okay. So that's sort of there's this contrast between coherent scattering versus incoherent scattering. So incoherent scattering basically means that if I wanted to, I could look and see what I scattered off of. Like, you know, which nucleon. And so if that's the case, then the different contributions to the total matrix element don't interfere with one another. You're just saying, okay, I take this one, I square it, and then I add it to this one, and I square it. But if the wavelength is actually bigger than the whole ensemble, there's physically no way. I mean, it's just the uncertainty principle. There's no way of knowing which of these things I scattered off of. And so what I do is I just add up this contributions from all of the nucleons in the nucleus. So if I want to know the matrix element of the nucleus out for some nucleon, this is just equal to the total number of nucleons in the nucleus times the corresponding operator. Whoops. What am I doing? For the nucleus. So basically, I'm just adding up the possibility that I scattered off of each of these things, because I can't separately determine that I scattered off of any of them. Okay? So if I do this, what I notice is that my m squared is actually proportional to the number of nucleons squared in my nucleus. Okay? And of course, the number of protons, we call this the number z. This is the number of, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Because they're so localized in one place. So it's just like if I had a water wave come and I have this tiny point that it's scattering off of, even if that point's made up of all kinds of interesting things, I'll never see it if my wavelength is bigger than that, because everything is scattering with the same phase. Okay? All I care about is sort of the total cross-section, if you will, of the scattering. Okay? So the number of protons we call this z, and the number of neutrons we call this a minus z. So this is the mass number of the atom this is the, you know, number of protons, this is the thing that determines what where it is in the periodic table. So what I find is that my m squared goes like the number of protons times my proton coupling plus the number of neutrons times my neutron coupling, and then I square it. Okay. So what this is telling me is that if Z and A are big numbers, this is a big number. This is much bigger than the nucleon chi cross section. And we see, as advertised, it's not dependent on the spin of the nucleus. It's not dependent on any property of the nucleus except just counting up how many protons and neutrons are in the nucleus. Okay? And doing that allows you to have these large enhancements over just what you might naively expect. Okay. So in particular, if I plug this into my differential cross section, I end up with something that's like kappa squared mn over 2 pi v squared z 2b up plus b down plus a minus z times the neutron coupling squared. Okay. So this is spin independent. And we say that it has an a squared enhancement. So for instance, if I take one of the leading dark matter detection experiments, which is xenon, that has a mass number of about 130. So this has an enhancement about 4 orders of magnitude over what you would just expect for the scattering off of a single nucleon. And it's just from the fact that you have a bunch of nucleons to scatter off of, and it can scatter off of this one or that one or that one, and then it coherently scatters off of all of them. Okay. Now, so this is at essentially zero momentum. This is in the large wavelength limit, okay, that this coherence is true. Now, technically, we're not actually scattering in the large wavelength, like infinitely large wavelength. There's actually some finite momentum here. So if I want my d sigma dE recoil at arbitrary momentum, what we're basically doing is doing an expansion in small momentum. So this is the cross section at zero momentum. And then we multiply by this thing, which is called a form factor. And what a form factor is it's basically saying that, well, if I start cranking up my momentum, I'm going to move from the limit where I'm coherently scattering off of everything to being a little bit sensitive to what the structure of the nucleons inside the nucleus is. Okay. So I can define some appropriately normalized function such that in the limit where my momentum goes to zero, this is just one. And then as I crank up my momentum, I'm going to lose a little bit of coherence because I'm going to start probing this interior structure a little bit. And if you've done anything like from Jackson's E&M textbook, basically this f of q squared, this is kind of like a Fourier transform of the geometry of the scatterer. So in the q squared goes to zero limit, you basically end up with a delta function scatterer. As q squared becomes a little bit bigger, you start noticing that there are little bits, and this is generally going to suppress your cross section a little bit. Okay? You're still going to end up with this large a squared enhancement, but if we're being really correct, you also need to account for the fact that you're not perfectly coherently scattering. Okay? And this is called the Wood-Saxon form factor that I'm going to give you. This is sort of the standard one that's used in calculating these things. And it's basically f of e recoil is 3 times a Bessel function of some quantity and then these are just some numerical constant. So this is some sort of phenomenological model that you can derive in, say, nuclear physics for how nucleons are arranged inside of an atom. So this is just something that we borrow from nuclear physics that makes our calculations a little more correct. You know, we don't want to overestimate the rate of scattering. Okay, you don't need to understand the origin of this. It's just something that if you're calculating a cross-section, you always have to plug it in to make sure that you're not overestimating things. Okay, so what we've shown is that the vector gives you a cross-section that's enhanced by a squared and that's spin independent. And it turns out that the same is true for a scalar, except the coefficients don't match quite as nicely because there's no symmetry that relates the UV and IR degrees of freedom. This is something that you just have to do in lattice QCD. Okay, so this is a bit of a whirlwind, but does anyone have any questions about this? You know, what it was we're doing or any particular aspect of it?
These form factors from some kind of phenomenological model. Mm-hmm. Is there like, is it literally just fitting, trying to fit data well, or is there like some physical intuition
about it? Yeah, I think that it's related to, you make some assumption about how the nucleons are arranged, and then you take the Fourier transform of that spatial thing. And then the coefficients are, I think, are determined from scattering experiments, right? Because in scattering, you sort of, as you go to higher energies, you're probing the structure. So this was like, you know, for a long time, it wasn't clear that there were quarks, right? We didn't know what the model of the nucleon is. So there are very extensive studies of like what nuclear structure is. Okay, so we can kind of just take those results and use them here. Okay, so in the last little while, I want to introduce the spin-dependent interactions. And it's going to proceed very much the same way, except for the fact that we're going to end up with a slightly different form for our matrix elements. So in particular, we're going to look at the axial vector interaction. Right? So we're going to see that this leads to a scattering that instead of coherently scattering off of all of the nucleons, is actually going to couple to some global property of the nucleus. So for the axial vector, our effective interaction is something that's like AQ chi bar gamma mu gamma 5 chi Q bar gamma mu gamma 5 Q. So as before, we want to take the matrix element. So we end up with something that's like chi out times this Dirac stuff times n out on this axial part of the current times this coefficient squared. So this part here, this we can evaluate using the same arguments that we used up here. This is just going to be this number kappa times u bar out gamma mu, gamma 5, u in. So that just follows from the normal derivation of the Feynman rules. And then as before, what we want to do is we want to go from quark to nucleon to nucleus. Okay. So we'll start with this, the quark going to the nucleon. So we say, OK, well, I have some matrix element with the nucleon initial and final states. And what we want is we want to express this in terms of some matrix element that's like just in terms of the nucleon fields. And then there's going to be something here, which we don't know what it is. And then there's going to be some coefficients in front. So what we're trying to do, once again, is match our quark-level interactions to our nucleon-level interactions. Okay. So we usually define some coefficient here. So this is the piece that is not calculable, at least in perturbative theory. This is just some number that we either have to do in lattice QCD or that we, for our purposes, we look up this number. But just by analogy from what we did up here, it's not surprising that we can write some equivalence. It's just it's not going to be as clean as it was before. Now, the question is what we have to do with these operators, right? Because we start with an operator that has a Lorentz index mu. And that transforms under parity transformations like an axial vector. We say, well, okay, we need some operator in our low energy theory that transforms, has Lorentz index mu, and that transforms like an axial vector. And in the non-relativistic limit, the only thing that transforms this way is a vector that's based on angular momentum. Okay, so remember we made this argument that angular momentum is an axial vector. And if nothing's moving around, then there isn't any orbital angular momentum. So you basically just have some intrinsic angular momentum associated with the nucleon. So what we're going to do is define this as S mu, where in the non-relativistic limit, S mu is basically the spin operator. I guess we use J. So this is sort of some ad hoc thing that we're doing. It's true that the only axial vector we can use is the angular momentum. And so what we're doing is we're taking something that's Lorentz invariant, computing into the non-relativistic limit, and then sort of backing up and saying, OK, well, this is what the four vector looks like in the non-relativistic limit. And I can get to the general relativistic limit by just doing boosts on this. But this is a perfectly well-defined operator. And I can write it in any frame just in terms of the boosts operators to that frame. But it's kind of messy, and everything we're doing is non-relativistic anyway. So this is when we write S mu, we're basically doing it as a shorthand for this vector here. But once again, we're sort of using the symmetries of the theory and saying, well, QCD doesn't break parity. And so if I have some parity transforming object here, I have some parity transforming object there. That's literally the only thing that we can write down. Okay. Okay. So this matrix element has to do with the spin of the nucleon times some numerical coefficient. So just like before, so just like up here, once we had the connection between the quark and the nucleon matrix elements, we could write down some effective interaction. We're going to do the same thing here. So this is, we're defining some constants here. So we have our original coefficients of the high energy theory. Sorry, not yet. Let me just write it all out. So on the dark matter side, we have the same form of the operator. And on the visible sector side, we have the nucleon operator sandwiching this S mu operator. And then we have the same thing for neutrons. Where the coefficients A nucleon are just the sum over the quark content of the quark coefficient, and then times this fudge factor here that allowed me to go from this one matrix element to the other. So I basically am just taking this relationship and plugging it into my interaction. Okay. All right, so I've now, once again, we're sort of part of the way there. We've moved from our interaction that involves quarks and chis to an interaction that involves nucleons and chis along with a spin operator. And so what we need to now do is go from the nucleon to the nucleus. So what we need to know is what is the expectation value of this operator Okay. So we're going to just define this. This is some terminology. This is some average spin. So we have some spin operator. And what we're doing is we're basically decomposing this nucleus into a bunch of nucleons. And we're saying, OK, what's the contribution of nucleon curly n to the spin of the total nucleus? Okay, and then we're going to do this for both, say, protons and neutrons. Okay. So this turns out being an empirically, whoops, I can't spell. This is some empirically determined number. And basically what we're trying to say is that there's some total n spin. And this is equal to, you know, the total p spin of all of the protons in the nucleus plus the total contribution of the spin from the neutrons. Okay. So what I can do is I can, so that's what this is here. I can say, well, so I'm measuring how much spin is due to, say, the protons and the neutrons in each nucleus. And then what I want to compare that to is, like, this is something that's easily determined. And this is, so the spins of the various nuclei, or you can just look them up. The problem is that we have these coefficients here. You know, so if my theory, for instance, only couples to neutrons, then I'm only coupling to the parts of the neutron that contribute to the nucleon spin. So what we're trying to do is figure out how, say, AP SP mu plus AN SN mu. So these are things I look up. These are aspects of my theory. And these things are going to add together to give me some coefficient times just the average spin of the nucleus. So this looks like a problem that we had in quantum mechanics. So in quantum mechanics, remember that we had, say, an electron that has some spin, E1. And then we had some other electron spin E2. And we wanted to compute the total angular momentum J, which was JE1 plus JE2. And so what we're going to end up doing, we're out of time, so we'll do this tomorrow. But we're basically going to show how you can move from the coupling of the dark matter to the individual nucleon spins. You have to add it together in a similar way in order to figure out how it interacts with the total nuclear spin. And what we're going to end up showing tomorrow is basically that if we write down the total differential cross-section, this looks a lot like what we were doing before, except instead of being proportional to a squared, which is the total number of nucleons, this is the total J squared eigenvalue of the nucleus. Okay. Anyway, so there's a bunch of formalism that I just threw at you. So in the tutorial today, you're actually going to work through some of these things in a little bit more detail. And I think for the spin-dependent stuff, because it's a little more confusing than I'd envisioned, I'll maybe put a little bit more detail. And then we can talk more about it tomorrow. Hopefully, it's a little bit clearer. And then we'll finish off with direct detection. Okay, are there any questions about this right now?
Sorry, when you were down the effective Lagrangian, where did those coefficients come from? It might have been just an earlier board.
These ones?
No. Like just the effective Lagrangian of like one? No. Well, yeah, I guess what you're.
So this one, I'm just taking this delta Qn, so this is the same delta Qn here, okay? And then I'm just multiplying and dividing by this Gf. This basically gives you dimensionless coefficients.
Okay.
So if you just look at this and I say, I want the Lagrangian that just directly involves the nucleon fields is going to be the same as the Lagrangian involving the quarks, but just with these added delta Qs, and with the S replacing the sort of Lorentz structure on this on the nucleon.
I guess what I mean is normally with an effective theory, you have some unknown coefficients that you need to match to UV theory.
Right. So that's basically this.
Oh, so that's I see.
This delta Q eta
isn't actually known.
That's right.
We
so
have
we
to
don't
match that.
That's right. So this is something that we have to look at.
Okay.
We have to compute it. So there are unknown quantities from the matching, but otherwise the form just transfers directly.
Okay. So tutorial this afternoon, and I guess I'll see you tomorrow morning.